Hi there, and welcome to episode 313 of the Ski Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today is a very special episode of the Ski Podcast, as we are going to be focusing on one of my favourite resorts, and one of the most famous resorts in the world, Chamonix. Now, regular listeners will know that I've recently returned from a two-month stay in Chamonix. This was a trip that my wife and I have been planning for several years, and having recently become empty nesters, and with both our children away working ski seasons, we decided the time was right to do a mini ski season of our own. After all, as Ferris Bueller says, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. Now, I could have picked from many great resorts for an extended stay in the Alps, but it was always going to be Chamonix. I first came here in 1980 on a family holiday, but it was when I was doing my ski seasons in the 90s I fell in love with the place. Whether I was working in Zermatt, Mirabel or Courchevel, I made it to Chamonix several times a season, always for the annual inter-resort Bosse de Bosse. That's another podcast I need to record one day. Sometimes to ski the famous Vallée Blanche or explore the fantastic backcountry, all in the shadow of Mont Blanc, Western Europe's highest peak at 4,810 metres. Since then, I've returned often, in the winter for the skiing, but in summer as well for trail running and hiking. Now, I often get asked, which is your favourite ski resort? And while Zermatt is definitely up there, Chamonix always comes top of the list. So what I'd like to do in this episode is try and explain why that is, why Chamonix is such a special destination, and why I'll keep returning there. So, where to start? Well, let's go back a bit. Quite a long way back, in fact, almost 300 years to 1741, when two intrepid British adventurers, William Wyndham and Richard Pocock, discovered, and I'm putting that in quotation marks in case you can't tell, the Mer de Glace, the longest glacier in France. Local heritage guide Bernadette Souda told me more. It's such a pleasure to be here with Bernadette Souda in the middle of Chamonix. Now, we've spoken before about the Winter Olympics in 1924, and it was so informative. We really wanted to have a chat with you again. And so right now, we're very close to the bottom of the Montanvert train. And these days, anyone can go up in the train to the Mer de Glace. But I know that you know the story of the first people to go up there, and I wondered if you could perhaps share that with us.
Yes, it's a real pleasure to see you again, Ian. So this famous little red train that everybody wants to use at least once to get up and see the glacier. The first people who did go up, well, that is the surprise, they were British. In 1741, we always talk about Wyndham and Pocock, who came to Chamonix because they heard about this Chamonix. Strange place with weird mountains, dangerous mountains all around.
Was there not a sort of story that the glacier, the Mer de Glace, was populated by demons or monsters or something?
Well, that was exactly, but it was all the glaciers, not only this one. The glaciers were very often represented like a dragon or a monster. The believing was that there were bad spirits in the mountains and in the glaciers.
Okay, and the locals didn't want to go there?
They did go close to, but not really much further. The locals did go to find the crystals in the mountains. They did go up to hunt the chamois, but they did not really adventure themselves higher up.
And so Wyndham and Pocock, British explorers, went up there. And I think where it started to change in terms of other people coming is they went back to the UK and they wrote about it and they told everyone about their findings.
Exactly. But the base also, why did they come, is this famous Grand Tour that all the British people did and that always led them to Geneva.
That's really interesting, a little insight into the path that people are going to follow when they take the Montanvert train. Let's move into the centre of Chamonix now and have a look at some of the statues that are there. Chamonix continued to draw interest as the 18th century progressed, especially when a Swiss scientist, Horace Benedict de Saussure, put up a reward for the first person to reach the summit of Mont Blanc. And on the 8th of August, 1786, local doctor Michel Paccard and climber Jacques Balmer became the first to make it successfully to the top. You can see all three individuals immortalised in two statues in the centre of Chamonix. Now, these are passed by hundreds of tourists each day, but I have a feeling that most have no idea of their significance. So let's turn to Bernadette again. to find out more about these key figures from Chamonix's history.
Right now we're standing next to one of the most famous statues in Chamonix. I'm sure lots of listeners will have seen it. Maybe not everybody necessarily knows what it is. What I can see is I can see two people staring up at Mont Blanc. One of them is holding a big stick and pointing, and the other guy looks like he's dressed in sort of slightly smarter clothes. I wondered if you could explain who these two are.
Well, you have very good eyes. You have already said something very important. One guy with his woolen socks, a shorter jacket, a little bag and a hat. And the other guy looks very smart, as you said, looks more like somebody from the city, from the town. So on the left side, from where we look, is Mr. Horace Bénédicte de Saussure, Swiss scientific, who is the, how could I say?
Is he the money man?
Well, I would like to say it in a nicer way. He is the scientific who wanted to go up to Mont Blanc to know what's happening up there. He's scientific. He wants to know what's under that snow there. And he knows that it cannot go by himself. He needs the help of the locals. And he's asking the people of Chamonix, please help me to find the way. This scientific from Geneva is pushing the locals to get out of their fear and think about how to manage where to go.
And he gave them a big incentive as well, didn't he? Because he put up a reward for the first people to go to the top.
He definitely did. So a few people tried, but it's definitely our Mr. Paccard and Mr. Balma who were the first people on top in 1786, 8th of August.
Okay, so this is de Saussure, the money man, Balma, one of the mountain men, and this statue that we're looking at here celebrated one of the anniversaries of the ascent. So when was the first ascent and when did this statue get
put up? So the first ascent is 8th of August 1786, and the statue was made 100 years later to celebrate the first climb.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned that first climb was Balmat and Paccard, but Paccard has his own statue.
Yes.
He has his own statue over there, so let's walk over and have a look at his.
Now, there is some debate about whether it was Balmat or Paccard who put their foot on the summit first. Let's have a look at the statue that is opposite the Restaurant Josephine.
So we've moved over to a second statue. Again, if you've been into Chamonix, you will know it. It's a man sitting on his own. He also has a staff. Again, he looks quite smart, certainly smarter than Balmat, the kind of mountain man. I wondered if you could tell us who this is.
Well, the clever people, they just turn around and his name is written on the other side. It's Michel Gabriel Paccard, doctor in Chamonix, and he went with Jacques Balma. They were the two first guys in 1786 on top of Mont Blanc. Unbelievable. Can you look? They don't have any gear. They have nothing. They just have big sticks. They have hardly a piece of rope. They have no crampons. They don't exist. They have just nails on the shoes that we call here the tricounis. But they have good legs. And I would say they have been very, very lucky. They have been lucky to get up. They have been lucky to come back down.
Yeah, and they had, you know, as opposed to modern mountaineers, there weren't ropes, ladders, you know, no crampons, just
no
those hobnail boots, no Gore-Tex,
no feathery wear. All the best they had was warm wool jackets.
Yeah.
But they had the knowledge of the locals. They have picked out the days where it seemed for them the best days, weather-wise, to go out and do it. I'm amazed to see is when now, look at the little children climbing up the rocks, and you can see that the knees of Mr. Paccard, the painting has a little bit faded.
Yep.
And his nose, because yep, everybody is putting their hands on. And just to see that the past of this statue, of the whole story that has made Chamonix famous, and the kids who climb on the monument, they don't even know who he is. And they're putting their feet on the granite, this granite that we have all around us.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I really love that.
It's fantastic. And just to clarify then, yeah, he was a local doctor. So whereas Balmat was sort of interested in the reward that de Saussure had put up, he wasn't really motivated by that.
No, because Paccard, as a doctor, he also did some botanical researches. He was also a bit scientific. He was more interested about to know what was up there, how to get there and what was up there. He was not interested in the reward.
And you said they had luck and, you know, they didn't have much equipment, but clearly they had a lot of courage as well, because they're going where no one had ever been before.
A lot of courage and good legs, muscles, minds working, being, how could I say, being concentrated. Move on. If we don't go here, where will we move a few meters to go there? They had to make their own way. Nobody had ever been. You have to concentrate to choose the right route.
And his statue came another anniversary as well. Exactly. You know, we know that the first ascent was in 1786 and his statue came up in
1986 when we celebrated the 200th anniversary. First anniversary, 100 years, is Mr. Balma and Mr. de Saussure. Second 200th anniversary is Mr. Picard.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, evidently climbing Mont Blanc when no one else had done it before, tremendous achievement. I don't think you could say that either of them, certainly Balma, wasn't a mountain guide as such, because the mountain guides, for which Chamonix is very famous, came after that. But let's find out about that next.
So when Balma returned to the summit a year later with de Saussure, he started a tradition of high mountain guiding in Chamonix that would lead to the founding of the famous Compagnie des Guides de Chamonix in 1821, the oldest guiding association in the world. And another part of Chamonix's heritage that tourists rarely notice is the mural on Rue Dr. Paccard, just opposite the Grand Hôtel des Alpes. Now, next time you're there, I recommend you take a few minutes to have a good look. I spoke with Bernadette again about the different figures shown in that mural.
Okay, we've moved on to the Place des Alpes, which is right by the Grand Hotel des Alpes. And there is a fantastic mural that many people will have noticed, but possibly never really given much consideration to. And this mural has lots of the most famous people in Chamonix history on it. Right at the top, I believe that's Marie Paradis, is that right?
You are correct. Wonderful. And thanks to start with the lady. Very good. So who is Marie Paradis? Is the first lady ever who climbed Mont Blanc in 1808. You remember the first climb for Balma and Paccard is 1786. So 20 years later, one lady is on top of Mont Blanc. Unbelievable. And she's not really a climber. She goes up because her friends, guides, say, come on, come with us. She is not really a climber. And she says the end of the story is, well, I was really feeling sick. The higher it went, the more sick I was. And I thought I was going to die. And I will never go back again. But so, she is the first.
But she was the first. And just below her, to the left then, is perhaps a first woman to be considered an alpinist to climb Mont Blanc.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's Henriette d'Angeville. The difference is that she is a proper climber. She does already climbing alpinism. And she comes to Chamonix to realize this climb of Mont Blanc. She goes to see the guides, hires the guides, and gets to the Mont Blanc. And the guides say, well, she did really do a good job. She was quite solid and came to the top.
That's very kind of them to say. So that was in 1838, so 30 years after Marie Paradis.
Exactly.
Yeah, and on the balcony she's sharing is with, that's Balma and Paccard up there as well, right?
Exactly. Balma always with his long stick. And you see Michel Gabriel Paccard on the left, and we are actually here now, just beside the Place des Alpes in the Paccard Street.
Perfect. And then other people who are on there, other people who are famous in Chamonix over the years. But on the lower level, we've got a number of the most famous guides from Chamonix, from the Compagnie des Guides.
Exactly. And first of all, you have number 1821, which retracts the creation of the guide company in Chamonix 1821 with five of the famous guides in the period. One of them is one of my favorite. The one on the right side is Michel Croc, born up in the village of Le Tour. He was very appreciated and loved in the valley. And he was with Edward Whymper, the first to climb the famous Matterhorn in 1865.
Right.
Unfortunately, he didn't come back from that
yes,
climb.
Yes, that's a different story.
That's a different story.
You said 1821, so that's when the Compagnie de Guide was formed. There was an incident in 1820 that led to the creation of the Compagnie de Guide.
Exactly. Unfortunately, an accident in 1820 where the guides take up a very important climb. First of all, they didn't want to go because the conditions were not the best. But after days of discussion, they decided to lead this client up to the Mont Blanc. And in the middle of the climb, big avalanche comes down and wipes out three of these guides. Three guides killed in one expedition. It was not a nice experience for Chamonix. And after that, the guides come down from this experience. They sit down together and talk and say, this should never happen again. We have to establish rules. We have to have proper written rules that our clients understand what we have to respect. First rule will be, it's not the client who decides.
Yeah.
It's the guide.
Yeah, that is fundamental. So in 1821, that's when the Compagnie de Guide was formed. And now you can still hire guys from the Compagnie de Guide right now. And actually, that really fits in well with the conversation I had with Brad
Wonderful.
Carlson, who yes. guided me out in the Alps. And he talked about how you qualify as becoming a guide.
You are very lucky to have Brad Carlson as a guide. He's a fantastic person and a fantastic guide.
Cool. That's fantastic, Bernadette. Thank you so much.
I have to say, Bernadette is so knowledgeable about Chamonix history. If you would like to hear more from her, I recommend you look up episode 200 in our back catalogue and you can listen to her insights about the inaugural Winter Olympics, which took place in Chamonix in 1924. Now, we mentioned Brad Carlson in that segment. Regular listeners to the show will remember that Brad featured in episode 308 when he guided me on a high mountain adventure in Chamonix. In between ski touring, rappelling and bootpacking in the Chamonix backcountry, I asked Brad about the demanding process to qualify as a mountain guide in France. Apologies for the sound quality on this. A bit like my challenges with Bernadette, with wind and dogs in the background, this interview was recorded in Brad's car in the parking in Grand Monte, so it's not quite perfect.
So we had a really interesting chat earlier about how you actually go about becoming a guide, and it takes a long time. I think the process, as you explained it to me, is to start off with, you've got to build up your portfolio, your resume. And that's quite complicated in itself, right? Because there are lots of different categories and a minimum number that you have to have tried.
For me, it was a 5-year project. Basically, there was two stages. One is to get the ability and experience necessary to do those more ambitious, more challenging routes. And then it took a few years, several years, to actually, you know, go through the process of finishing that entire resume. So there's high mountain rock climbing, there's snow and ice, gullies, there's summer mountaineering on ridges, water ice climbing, and also, of course, ski touring.
Cool. And this resume, essentially, to get the French qualification, there's a big list of all of these different routes and destinations that you can choose from, I guess, are kind of across the country. But some of them are compulsory to do as well.
For each category, there are two or three mandatory routes that you have to pull from a list that the ENSA, the National School of Alpinism and Skiing, has already established. So let's say you have 10 rock climbs to do. Well, three of them have to come from this particular list that they've kind of pre-vetted.
So it takes you a while to build up your resume. Then once you've got it, you get grilled on it. There's a kind of interview about your experience, right?
Yeah, they make sure you've done it, that you've understood what you've done and were able to recognize key features and dangers. And then you get started with the technical exams.
Exactly. But isn't that only the opportunity to take the exams to be able to take the course in the first place?
Yeah, those entrance exams are just to get started. And they recently added a new thing where you actually have to do a multi-victim avalanche beacon drill before anything else.
Okay, makes
sense. Before the interview, they absolutely want all the candidates to have those skills polished and solid. And then it's also convenient because it already weeds out a few candidates. so they have fewer people to interview and deal with.
Okay, that kind of makes sense, but clearly, as you say, fundamental as part of it. Yeah. So you go through the initial process, then you can actually start your studying, and that process, how long does that take?
There are 2 weeks of exams. It's pretty intense to get started, and then once you're into it, it's minimum 3.5 years.
And actually, one of the things you said to me is in the French system, it's actually subsidized by the French government, is that right?
Yeah, it is all under the umbrella of the French Minister of Youth and Sport. The ENSA is a public institution, and I can't remember exactly what the total is, but it's under 10,000 euros for the whole process. And it's not nonstop for 3.5 years. I believe it's the equivalent of like 9 months of courses and exams spread out.
But you've got to have the availability. You've got to be able to go to the location where the courses are. But at the end of those 3.5 years, you can then say, right, now I am is it UIAGM?
That's correct. That's the French acronym, and the English acronym is IFMGA.
And therefore, you are a qualified mountain guide. You can take people in summer and winter with that qualification, high mountain, low mountain, covers all of the options. You, for example, you know, a lot of your clients are private, but you're also a member of the Compagnie des Guides here in Chamonix as well. How does that process work to become a member of the Compagnie des Guides?
So yeah, the diploma is one thing. And then the other question is who you work for or with as a guide. I wanted to work with the local historic Chamonix Guides company here. It was a several year process to become a member there as well.
Yeah, and you have to be approved, I guess, to be able to become a guide.
Yeah, you start out, it's a big pyramid, kind of like a law firm maybe, with different levels of membership. At the very end, you become a tenured member where you're basically co-opted, voted in by the General Assembly. And there's big party after that. It's a very cool festive moment. Every year, there tend to be 2 to 4 new guides that get voted in. But yeah, it's another multi-year process. It's you have to want to work for them and they have to want to work with you. So it takes a little time to build that confidence.
For sure. And I think I'm right in saying it's the oldest Société des Guides in the world, certainly in France, for sure.
It's the oldest and largest in the world, founded in 1821.
Yeah, has an amazing reputation. But so you get a lot of your clients privately, but how would a guide who's a member of the Compagnie des Guides pick up clients through the organization then? How does that work?
So there's a very traditional process where every night, every evening at 6 p.m., they distribute the available work for the next day. And it's completely fair. There's all of the names of the members are up on a bulletin board. And there's a pin next to the name of the person who's the last person to take work the night before. And then the head guide starts calling the next name on the bulletin board down the list. And whoever's there, once their name gets called, shows up and they say, okay, I want to take that work or I don't. And then 15 minutes later, they're calling the client.
Right. Okay. So say, for example, I decided, right, I'm in Chamonix. The weather looks good. I'd like to do the Vallée Blanche tomorrow. I contact the Bureau des Guides and they allocate it just like that to whoever's available and is top of the queue.
That's right. And it's been working like that for, as you can imagine, a very long time. And it's completely fair. You have to be there in order to get the work. So it's a bit, you know, maybe anachronistic, but the system works. And it's a very strong tradition at the Chamonix Guides Company.
Yeah, I don't think it's anachronistic at all. And what you know is that anyone who you're employing through the Société des Guides is someone who's been through an extreme long process to be able to get there. They're going to be experienced and they're going to have the skills. As you demonstrated with us taking us on this high mountain adventure around Chamonix the last couple of days. That's brilliant, Brad. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that, Ian. Thanks.
I don't want to give the wrong impression. Chamonix is not just about hardcore skiing and hiring guides. The Mont Blanc Unlimited Pass includes the 4 Chamonix ski areas, Les Ouches, Brevent Flégère, Grandmonté, and Le Tour Balme. But you can also ski at Saint-Gervais, Megève, Les Contamines, and via the Mont Blanc Tunnel at Courmayeur in Italy. There is so much variety. Les Ouches, Saint-Gervais, and Courmayeur are all great for skiing in the trees on bad weather days. Brevent and Flégère offer unbeatable views of the Mont Blanc Massif. Le Tour has perhaps the best intermediate skiing on piste, but it also has great off-piste options in the Balme sector. And Grandmonté? Well, that is legendary for a reason. There are just 4 lifts there, although that will soon change, more of that later, and fantastic off-piste options. But be warned, this is not Les Travelers. Officially, the Mont Blanc Unlimited Pass gives you access to over 1,000 kilometres of skiing. But you can't ski from resort to resort as you can in big French areas such as the Espace-Ski, Paradis-Ski or the Porte du Soleil. If you're used to those ski areas, it might be a surprise that you need to drive or take the bus or the train to each ski area. Chamonix can be, but is rarely, a ski-to-the-door resort. But the skiing is varied. There's something for everyone. And to my mind, it's the fact there is so much you can do in Chamonix that marks it out as special. And that includes two must-do lifts. Montanvert, the rack and pinion railway that takes you up to the Mer de Glace, the same glacier that Wyndham and Pocock first visited almost 300 years ago, albeit significantly smaller now. And of course, the famous Aiguille du Midi cable car, which is a must for any trip to Chamonix. Technically, the Klein Matterhorn top lift in Zermatt is slightly higher, but the Aiguille du Midi has the highest vertical ascent of any lift in the world, whisking you from 1,035 metres in town to 3,842 metres in just 25 minutes. Stand facing back down if you want to see Chamonix turn into a toy town below you, or go to the front and face upwards, especially on the second stage, to get a real appreciation of how incredibly steep that final section is. And while any trip to the Aiguille du Midi gives you amazing views, it will also bring you into contact with the high mountain, hardcore aspect of Chamonix. It's where the Vallée Blanche starts from. And in winter, you'll see skiers edging down the arête. But that's the vanilla action. This is also where you'll see all of those people walking around Chamonix with ropes, harnesses and ice axes in action, going climbing, touring or rappelling down steep couloirs. I went up the Aiguille du Midi 3 times in my 2 months in Chamonix. It's included if you have a Mont Blanc Unlimited Pass, and I would absolutely recommend a visit. It is so special up there, and give yourself at least 2 hours for the round trip, if not 3, to take it all in. It was pretty windy when I recorded this next segment on my last trip up there in April. As well as the wind and my simple pleasure at being there, you'll hear the clinking carabiners of some climbers who just scaled a vertical face to clamber onto the viewing platform I was standing on.
Up in the Aiguille du Midi now. It's middle of April, but there's a bit of wind and there's a serious chill. Might be minus 20, I think. And this is high mountain. We've got people with crampons on, roped together, walking across what looks to be an impossible traverse. I'll be crawling on my hands and knees, but that just looks ridiculous. And then other guys coming up what I take to be the cosmic couloir where skiers in winter go down. I can see other ski tourers crossing the Bossong Glacier on their way to the Grand Moulet hut, I would guess. I can see other people skiing down above the Tachonas Glacier. And then looking down in the valley, well, as far as Solange, I see Saint-Gervais, Megève, I can see Flen in the distance over there. It's just amazing. If you ever come to Chamonix, you have to come up here, you have to spend time up here.
I mentioned that the Aiguille du Midi is the start of the famous Vallée Blanche, the 22-kilometre off-piste run that takes you over the glacier and back down to Montanvert. I skied it for the first time in 1980 at the age of 13, and I've done it again many times since. It's very accessible, exciting backcountry skiing. I know plenty of Chamonix locals who do it without a guide, but I personally do not recommend that, simply because glaciers are constantly changing, both due to climate change and simply because they are always in motion. I spoke to Chamonix local David Webster, aka Chamonix Ski Bum on YouTube, about the changes he's seen to the Vallée Blanche since he's been in resort. I'm interested, you've been in Chamonix for 7 or 8 years. Would you say that you've seen changes in the Vallée Blanche due to climate change on the Mer de Glace, you know, during that time?
Oh, absolutely. Every single season, you can really notice a difference the first time you come down, how much the glacier has receded. Glaciers are living, breathing things almost. They change day to day, but especially year to year. Not just the glacier retreat, which is very shocking and very obvious as you're down the lower portion on the Mer de Glace, but even up on the mountain, the seracs move, crevasses move, everything changes. One season you might go down a pitch, which is perfect snow. The next year you get there, it'll just be bare rock, or it might be overhanging serac. It's an overhanging block of ice, so it's completely unskiable. It changes every day, and especially every season, both through climate change and just through the natural movement of the ice.
I'll be publishing a much longer interview with David later this summer. But a point he made there was that the constant changes to the glacier mean that even small mistakes can leave you in a crevasse. This can be for the most experienced skiers, or even, if you're very unlucky, for first-timers. I spoke to regular guest on the show, Sam Haddad, about her very eventful first experience on the Vallée Blanche.
I'd started snowboarding the year before, fallen in love with Chamonix, given up everything I was doing in London to kind of move out there and do a season. And in week one, we hired a guide. I was a novice snowboarder, but, you know, good enough. You know, I could stop at any time. Yeah, it was good enough to be doing it. We went down the route called Envers du Plan. Beautiful. I can still picture it in my head. It was like a dreamy morning. The ridge part was obviously scary, but added to the adrenaline of it. And then we started to go, when we broke off to the left to the Envers du Plan route, I was at the back of the group. And the guide had said to us, you know, make sure you stay kind of in our tracks. Don't go, you know, to the left or to the right of our tracks. So I think I probably didn't take that literally enough. And so 1 minute I'm snowboarding, the next minute there's just the ground falls beneath me. Like it just felt like I was just going down this kind of helter-skelter slide, but with my board.
So you're just snowboarding along. And effectively, I guess you were going over a snow bridge or something and it just collapsed beneath you. Is that what happened?
Yeah, so I put a toe turn in. Later, I would find out that it was a snow bridge and it collapsed beneath me.
Okay, and how far did you fall and how did you stop?
I just sort of came to and I was just sitting on a ridge. There was a thud where my side of kind of glute, my bum kind of hit some hard ice. They sort of said 10 meters at the time. It was a scraping and a bit of falling and a scraping. So when I remember it, it wasn't like I was bungee jumping down or anything like that. It was more crunch, crunch, crunch. And then I was left on this, ledge.
And I mean, this might be a silly question, I don't know, but what thoughts are going through your mind at that very point? Because I think time slows down.
Time does slow down, but then it also was quite quick. It was kind of a blur of sound and things that I hadn't experienced. And at that moment, I don't think I was really thinking crevasse. I knew we were on a glacier and it was dangerous, but I didn't know what a crevasse was. I mean, I'd done geography at uni, so I should have done, but I obviously had no idea what the inside of a crevasse looked like. And it was this ice cave. As soon as I stopped, I felt completely safe on that ledge. I was stable. There was enough of a ledge that I felt safe. But when you look down, when I leant forward, there was the abyss. Not the abyss in an open way, but an abyss that if I'd pushed myself off of it, I could have kept going down these kind of bluey ice tunnels.
I am delighted to say that this story had a positive ending, although it did end up with Sam being helicoptered off the mountain. I'll be releasing my full conversation with Sam later this summer, so you can catch up on the whole story then. But I think it demonstrates why, all around Chamonix, you'll regularly see people loaded up with all the kit you need for skiing or snowboarding in these harsh environments. I thought it might be interesting to learn more about exactly what you want to have with you. So let's hear from Brad again. I asked him to tell us more about the kit we took on our ski touring trip in March.
So we're just getting ready to go out for the day, and you've equipped us with a harness here. Now, I thought it might be interesting for some of the listeners to kind of understand like what we've got on this and why we've got it on there. So I wondered if you could just kind of like talk us through it. I know, that's a carabiner, right? And that we used yesterday, so do you want to run through what that's for?
Yeah, so for starters, we always have a harness on when skiing on a glacier. It's just a necessary precaution, because there is the risk of falling into a crevasse. We're obviously trying to avoid that, but if someone does go into a crevasse, the harness is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and you explained as well the reason for this item is should the worst happen in that kind of situation. So do you want to explain what this is and how you'd use it?
Yeah, so on our harness, we have an ice screw, which is a very specialized way of making an anchor in ice. And if someone does go into crevasse, the thought is you put in this ice screw, you know, just twist it into the ice. And then we also have this handy tether here, which allows you to clip into the ice screw and essentially make yourself safe while waiting for rescue. And then we also have this carabiner that you mentioned, which is just a convenient way of tying into the rope on a glacier. Just a really quick clip in, boom, it's done. You're tied in. So that's kind of our basic ensemble for being on the glacier. And then I've got a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, a pulley, a rappel device, some slings, all in kind of a rescue, you know, just in case mindset.
So what was that other thing that you were using when we were going up the rocks? You kind of gripped it between the rocks to kind of create a pivot.
Yeah, so with the glacier receding, the Col du Chalonnet is becoming steeper and more technical. And so guides are sharing, we're sharing information constantly just ourselves. And I heard from a colleague, hey, it's gotten steeper. You should bring one of these cams, they're called. And it's a way of creating an anchor in the rock. So ice screw, create an anchor in the ice. A cam is this mechanical device that you put into a parallel-sided crack. It's also, the French call it a friend. Which is the first brand to make them.
Ah, I see.
It's okay. It's like a Kleenex.
Right, cool. You
know, but the actual name is a cam.
Now, ideally, you'll never need to use much of that kit. But while the majority of skiers are on piste in Chamonix, there is a lot going on in the high mountain. When I was in resort, our apartment looked out towards Mont Blanc, and I typically start each day sweeping the slopes with my binoculars. Some days there'd be climbers making their way up to the Aiguille de Midi on the Mallory route. Pretty much every day there would be tiny ants that were ski tourers heading out of the Grand Moulet refuge and making their way up via the Petit or Grand Plateau or via the Dôme de Goûter. This is the hardcore ski touring, but a much more accessible intro to the high mountain is the Haute Route, the hut-to-hut route that connects Chamonix with Zermatt. And every year, around 2,000 skiers complete the Haute Route. This spring, a new record was set of 13 hours and 27 minutes. We covered that in episode 311, but typically it takes 5 to 7 days to complete. Podcast listener Sasha Ryazentsev let me know that he was taking on the Haute Route while I was in Chamonix, so I met up with him afterwards to ask him how it went.
Right, I'm just here with Sasha Ryazentsev, listener to the podcast. Really nice that we've managed to meet up in person here in Chamonix. And you're on the back end of having just done the Haute Route. How did you find it, Sasha?
In a couple of words, Ian, it's really, really tough, right? So just to give you some idea, I've skied in quite a few places in the world, but I don't really do ski touring, right? It's my very first time ski touring, and it happened to be the Haute Route, which I found incredibly difficult in the first day, but then I eased into it and it became more pleasant, and I loved it. I must say, if I had to do it tomorrow, maybe I will have a day's break, but I'll be back again.
Cool. And, you know, when we were chatting earlier just now, I think one of the things that you said that struck you, you've done a little bit of ski touring before, but in this, the weight of the pack, everything that you're carrying, because you've got a lot of stuff with you for this type of event.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the surprises for me, the fact that you have to carry so much weight. And the one thing I would say is that you have to try to make it as light as possible. Obviously, don't carry too much stuff outside of your equipment, but also the equipment that you take, make sure it's as light as possible, whether it's crampons, ski crampons, your harnesses and anything else. Just get as light a rucksack as possible.
For sure, it all adds up, you know, when you're going up a 1,000 meter vertical in a single go. And every night you were staying in refuges. It was really interesting just talking to you about some of the aspects of that, because I think you tend to find on the Haute Route that people are going from the same hut to the same hut. So there was a bit of camaraderie with the other people who weren't necessarily in your group, but you'd see them every evening.
100%. Once you go out of Argentina hut, you see more and more people who are doing exactly the same route as yourselves. Between 40 and 50 people are staying in the same hut. There were French, Swedish, Austrian, Swiss, of course. You know, there's quite a few people, you know, really good skiers. And, you know, look, it was great. The huts were amazing.
And what about the food in the huts?
You know what? Once you've done 1,200 meters of ascent going up the hill, you will eat absolutely anything.
And, you know, sometimes people kind of say you only need one person snoring to kind of ruin it. Was there anything like that?
For me, it was absolutely fine. I mean, I did hear a lot of snoring, but genuinely, no, it was fine.
Well, congratulations on an amazing experience. And you said you'd like to try it again, maybe in another year or something like that.
Absolutely. You have to be prepared and make sure that you've packed your rucksack, make sure you've got the fitness level and you've had experience touring, and trust in your guide and respect the mountain. And if the mountain says you can't go, you can't, but do enjoy it.
Cool, that's brilliant, Sasha. Thank you very much.
The Oat Route is the most famous multi-day off-piste experience out of Chamonix. Let's track back to that famous single-day experience, the Vallée Blanche. When you do this route, you'll end up at Montanvert. Now, when I first skied it in 1980, the Mer de Glace hadn't receded to the extent that it has today. My memories may be rose-tinted, but we just walked off the glacier to the Buvette and then skied down to Chamonix. And while you can still occasionally ski down to Chamonix, until a couple of years ago, you needed to walk over 500 steps up from the glacier to then make your descent by train to resort. There is an excellent, if slightly depressing, museum called the Glaciorium at Montanvert that I highly recommend. Most people rush off the train onto the gondola to go down to the ice cave, but I recommend you break from the crowd, go past the Refuge de Montanvert and follow the signs to the Glaciorium. It's super educational about the annual life cycle of the glacier and the changes it has seen, and it will really give you some context about the impact climate change has had. Now, we heard from David Webster earlier on about some of the changes he has seen on the Mer de Glace. Let's turn to Brad again. I spoke to him in 2024, just after the gondola had opened.
Let's look at ice climbing first. It's affected you and guides and the ability to do ice climbing on the Mer de Glace?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I passed my entrance exams to become a mountain guide in 2016. And so we were climbing on these seracs and sort of ice canyon walls that are long since gone. And so even on a pretty short time scale, the change has just been tremendous. Over the course of a single season, for example, in 2022, which was extremely hot summer in the Alps and throughout Europe, the Mer de Glace lost 17 meters of thickness just under our feet between the late spring and the autumn. So it's not even from year to year. It's really month to month, we're adapting to a constantly changing environment.
But when we were chatting in the green room before, you said it's almost like your office is melting.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, we're out there doing ice climbing, finishing the Vallée Blanche. In a way, you know, this high mountain environment is our office. And, you know, it's almost like it's melting out from underneath us. It's just the change is extremely rapid. We could talk about impact because, of course, as guides, and as being part of the tourism industry, we have an impact, you know, in terms of emissions. But from an adaptation standpoint, no matter what, we're absolutely confronted by this rapid change.
When you're guiding people on the Vallée Blanche at the moment, I think we'll discuss how the lift impact on it. But without that lift, it's quite a physical exercise to get from the bottom of the Vallée Blanche, from the Mer de Glace up to Montanvert to descend to Chamonix.
Yeah, certainly. In the 80s, early 90s, when you could ski all the way out to the Moté snack bar, you know, the change has just been tremendous. Skiing the Vallée Blanche these past years, you know, often the snow cover is quite low at the very end, can be a bit rocky. And then there's this strenuous walk up a metal staircase up to the gondola built in the late 80s, where the glacier arrived at the time. And so that combination of some tricky skiing, maybe some walking at the end, plus, you know, a half hour, 40 minutes of walking up a staircase with your heavy ski equipment in the full sun after a long day in the mountains. Yeah, it's definitely strenuous. The new gondola, you know, we could say, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it productive adaptation or just kicking the can down the road? But what's for sure is that it makes the Vallée Blanche in its current state much more accessible, much less physically strenuous. And certainly as guides, it makes our job a lot easier to get to the end of the Vallée Blanche. And then we can, you know, walk up just a few flights of stairs instead of, you know, hundreds of steps and be whisked up to the Montanvert train. So it definitely makes the Vallée Blanche more accessible. I think that, you know, as mountain guides, we're, once again, it's making our job easier and it's maintaining access, hopefully even for the years to come, to the Mer de Glace Basin, which is absolutely key for us, both for the Vallée Blanche descent during the winter and also in the summer for accessing the five high mountain huts that are key base camps for alpinism around the Mer de Glace.
To me, it sounds like it would be ideal if it wasn't required, but if it improves access overall for both summer and for winter and enables more people to be able to benefit from seeing something spectacular like the Mer de Glace, which sadly, maybe by the end of this century, you know, it's not going to be there. But in that interim, while it is, I think the more people who can appreciate it, the better.
So we've learned about the physical changes Chamonix has seen over the years, and the Montanvert gondola is an excellent example of the resort adapting to that. Another new lift currently under construction in Chamonix is the new Grand Monte lift in Argentière. Now, you may be aware that since a fire at the mid-station at Lognan in 2018, it has not been possible to reach the 3,300-metre point at Grand Monte by lift. However, that is about to change with the opening of the first stage this winter in December 2026 and the second section in December 2027. This is a massive €155 million project, and I spoke with Benoit Barrel from the company de Mont Blanc about it.
On arrivait, le téléphérique arrivait beaucoup plus haut et on avait une, j'ai plus le nombre en tête, mais on avait un nombre de marches pour descendre jusqu'au col, et on chaussait au col pour partir soit sur le bassin d'Argentière, soit, et là, dans les échanges avec les services de l'État, on a démonté les escaliers, on a mis la gare beaucoup plus basse, réalisé un tunnel, le tunnel est déjà terminé, un tunnel qui est relativement plat à 5%.
So, the only catch here, which you may have noticed, is that that interview was in French. So, I'm not going to play the whole thing here. I will write it up for one of the ski magazines for this autumn. But for now, I can tell you that once fully open, it's going to make a huge difference to high mountain access. The plan is for the lift to stay open around 9 months a year, from November through to September. And that means much easier access, not just to the skiing in the Grand Monte area, but to the refuges that Brad referred to, currently reached via Montanvert in summer. It means that when the ski area officially closes in early May, as it does at present, backcountry skiers will still be able to get up to the snow line. When I left Chamonix earlier this month, it was snowing down to 1,800 metres in mid-May, with substantial snow higher up. And currently, the only lift operating is the Aiguille de Midi. But having the Grand Monte open as well would really open up the accessible terrain, as well as making the start of the Haute Route slightly easier. So, we've heard how Chamonix has changed physically in terms of the impact of global warming. And the new gondola at Montanvert and the new Grand Monte lift are both examples of changes to the infrastructure. These two developments will help Chamonix's all-year-round appeal. There are lots of resorts trying to pivot from just skiing to becoming four-season destinations. But Chamonix is unusual in that it has already achieved this. It's a rare alpine destination that is busier in summer than it is in winter. The Aiguille de Midi and Montanvert lifts are a big part of that. But many people are drawn here for the hiking and the trail running. The world famous UTMB race, the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc, starts and finishes here. And UTMB week is insane. Around 10,000 trail runners converge on the resort for the World Series finals in August. And the town is full of super fit people everywhere for that week. Now, competitors in the main UTMB race complete the Tour de Mont Blanc in a single go. The winners do it in about 20 hours. The maximum allowed is 46 hours. But more commonly, it takes much longer. I spoke to international mountain leader Sam Morton about the recreational version.
Now, I've been talking about you can do all the trail running, the UTMB, but you don't have to be an international ultra runner to do the Tour de Mont Blanc. Maybe we can give a sense for listeners of what that involves. So how long does that take?
6 days is average for a running trip, but it can be anything up to 8, 9, 10, even 11 days if you want to do it at a slightly more leisurely pace.
Okay, and what about levels of fitness then? How fit do you need to be able to do this type of thing?
I mean, you don't need to be a super fit ultra runner, but it certainly helps if you've done some preparation. It is 100 miles and there is roughly 10,000 metres of ascent and descent at altitude on some fairly tough terrain. So you have to be prepared for that. You know, it's not plain sailing and it's not super easy every step of the way.
Sure. And then what about overnight then? So you said, you know, it could take anything between, you know, 4 and 10 days.
Yeah.
What's your accommodation going to be? Because, you know, when I've done it, I've stayed in refuges sometimes, but there are different stops along the way where you can stay in hotels as well. How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, certain areas there are hotels available. You might have to take some transport on and off the trail to get to that. But the vast majority of people stay in refuges, mountain huts, that have big dorm rooms, so you might be side by side with people that you've never met before.
And what about the best time of year to do it? When would you recommend?
The season normally opens sometime in June. You can do it a little earlier than that, But the refuges don't usually open till June and they close in September. So outside of that peak season, you haven't got as much accommodation availability.
But evidently, it depends on the snow, because the snow line at the moment, you know, it wouldn't be feasible to do the Tour de Mont Blanc right now. We're just coming into May.
Yeah.
I guess another factor is as well, if you're going in the higher season, you really need to make sure that you reserve those refuges in advance. Otherwise, they do get booked out.
Yeah,
right?
They do get booked out, and they get booked out really early. So most people have to make their reservations the year before they plan to do it. If you're in a small group, you might get in with a last minute booking, but it definitely pays to book in advance.
Okay, well, that's brilliant, Sam. I'll put a couple of links in the show notes so people can find out a bit more about that. Thank you very much.
So hopefully this podcast so far has given you a sense of the history of Chamonix, the long association with guiding and the massive potential for ski mountaineering, as well as the draw of the resort as an all year round location. I've been visiting Chamonix for over 40 years and guess what? It's changed quite a lot. I don't just mean the changes due to climate change. So many of the locals I spoke to talked about how Chamonix has changed away from the hardcore skiers and more to the day trippers. Now, certainly the town has moved up market. There's a few reasons for that, starting with the rise of the low-cost flights in the early 2000s and then combined with the rise of Airbnb in the 2010s. Chamonix, perhaps more than any resort, used to be full of ski bums, squeezing as many as feasibly possible into small apartments in Cham Sud to keep costs down. Now, those same apartments are rented out for weekends instead of the whole winter. And while there are still a few Scandinavians here eking out a season, Brexit has decimated the number of British ski bums coming to Chamonix. I spoke to Iona Halley from Mountain Massage about the changes she's seen in her time in resort.
You've been a resident of Chamonix for 16 years and we've seen quite a lot of changes in that time. You mentioned to me earlier that your husband owns a hire shop. I think maybe with the rise of Instagram, am I right in saying that some people are more interested in getting photos than actually doing the skiing?
Yes, he does get some clients that come to the shop. They don't ski, but they come and they hire the skis, the boots, the poles, and they go up to the Brevon just to get that key shot, key photo for Instagram or TikTok.
I mean, that is a huge change. I think if you look in the high street anytime, there's lots of people who are, you know, tourists. I mean, I'm a tourist here, but they're not carrying skis, they're not carrying boots, etc. And I guess that is one of the changes. We've seen a lot of the restaurants and cafes maybe go up market. You mentioned to me before that you thought that maybe since a pandemic, you know, that's affected by people who are kind of working remotely.
Yes, probably there's a lot more people that can work remotely. So it's a lot easier for them to come to Chamonix and work and enjoy the mountains.
And we've seen a change as well. I guess you get fewer seasonaires. The rise of Airbnb means in general, a lot of the tourists who are coming are a bit better off than they used to be, right?
Yes, no, definitely. Because of Brexit, definitely less seasonaires, British seasonaires, a bit more people that are coming with more funds.
Yeah.
So they can afford to rent accommodation.
There are some very nice cafes and restaurants, and they always have been in Chamonix, but some of them are quite smart now. There's one I've been to a couple of times called Tartine. There's another one called Shuka, and if anyone's been to Chamonix recently, they may have gone to Shuka. It's on Rue Dr. Paccard. Very, what I would describe as a posh coffee place. We were talking earlier. I wonder if you could just let listeners know what it used to be like.
So used to be Shuka was a nightclub that you could go to and it was free. So if you'd been out and had a few beers and you were on the way home and you were with your mates, you could just stop in at the Shuka and possibly be there until about 2 o'clock in the morning and dancing.
It's hard to imagine now when you can kind of choose between, I don't know, Peruvian and Paraguayan coffee or something like that. I'm sure it's very good coffee, but you know, that's what it used to be like. And the way I remember it as well, you used to get like lots of mountaineers and, you know, hardcore guides in there before their trips. But you know, there are places that haven't changed within Chamonix. We talked about Bard Up, which is in the Rue de Moulin. You could still go down there and have your après ski afterwards. You mentioned that quite a lot of locals go to Elevation.
Yes, Elevation. That's definitely been here for a long time. And it's definitely a place that I went to meet locals when I moved here.
And then just opposite, Chambre-Neuf. That doesn't seem to have changed very much.
No, definitely not. It's still après ski. A good place to go to get hot and sweaty.
Yeah, I walked past earlier this winter, and it was full of people, you know, dancing on the tables and having a good time. So it's really good to see that maybe there have been quite a lot of changes in Chamonix. Maybe some of the people are coming and not doing so much skiing, but a lot of people are coming and skiing hard and partying hard as well.
Yes, definitely. It's still got that feel to it.
Look, Chamonix's changed. I mentioned the Chouquin in my chat with Iona. That's gone way upmarket, and it's not the only venue to go that way. Long-term visitors to Chamonix might remember the Terrasse in the centre of town. I went there for the Boss to Boss prize giving, an after party back in the 90s. Now it's the Pont de Rose and has lobster and oysters on the menu. The Vagabond was probably the best value accommodation in Chamonix, offering dorms, complete with a climbing wall out the back. That's now the Big Mountain Bar, offering a range of craft beers brewed on the premises. I actually really liked it there, but it's just another example of that trend upwards. Change is inevitable, and not all change is for the worse. The fact is that, like a lot of tourism destinations, Chamonix has simply adapted to a wealthier clientele. Another recent addition is the QC Therm, an amazing spa complex with multiple saunas and steam rooms and amazing outdoor infinity pools looking out over Mont Blanc. But this amazing place just wouldn't exist in a resort populated purely by ski bums. Yes, there are tourists who come to Chamonix just to get a photo for the gram. And yes, it's pretty sad that some of them rent ski equipment just to look good in that shot. But I'm not going to criticise them. I'm not a gatekeeper for Chamonix. It was a privilege to spend a couple of months in this magnificent place. But the truth is, I'm not a local. I'm also a tourist. And I've come because it's special there. For all the influencers and the sightseers, there's always still someone weaving between the selfie sticks, with skis on their back, carabiners clinking, and eyeing up the next line in the high mountains above. Chamonix is a special place, and I hope that in the course of the last hour, I've at least given you a sense for why that is, through the history, the epic lifts that can land you next to monumental glaciers, and of course, the alpine adventures on offer. I don't think it matters when you come, whether you want to ski, hike, or simply to get that selfie. A visit to Chamonix should be on everyone's wish list. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed putting it together. I interviewed so many people while I was in Chamonix, and I kept thinking, this is so interesting. I'm never going to be able to fit it into this single episode. So I'm delighted to announce that, as well as this special, the Ski Podcast is going to run a series of Chamonix stories, which will feature extended versions of some of the conversations featured in this episode, plus others with local businesses and entrepreneurs that I wasn't able to include here at all. Look out for the first of those, a chat with Chamonix-based Zach Skis coming up next week. There are now 313 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, all available at theskipodcast.com. Just have a search around the tags and categories. You are bound to find something you'll find of interest. I love getting feedback from our listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, or if you have any comments, please do let me know. You can do that by leaving a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. We're also on WhatsApp. I release exclusive material ahead of each episode on there. So look in the show notes for all those links. If you did enjoy this episode and you'd like to support the Ski Podcast, you are very welcome to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. For now, I would like to thank all of my interviewees who contributed to this episode, including Bernadette, Brad, David, Sam, Sasha, Benoit, Sam, and Iona. Plus, I would like to thank Natalie Tortora for her help in arranging some of these interviews. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.